Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 28th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. Can't believe that a month that has brought us so much progress on climate has come almost to an end.
The world keeps turning. Mm-hmm. So, D.R., one of the interesting articles that I noticed this week, I think you saw it as well, was a commentary from a gentleman named Ross Gelbspan that was up on the Huffington Post. He put up a blog. For those who don't know, don't recognize the name, Ross Gelbspan in the 1980s was he won a Pulitzer Prize with the Boston Globe. Mm-hmm. And in the early 1990s, he wrote a couple of very influential books called The Heat Is On and
Boiling Point.
Boiling Point. Which were one of the first exposés. I mean, this is back in the time when Bill McKibben was writing The End of Nature, right? It's all sort of, he came out and said that the climate crisis was real and happening, and he actually took a lot of grief for it. I mean, he got harassed basically by the bad guys back in the day, and he has basically spent a lifetime working on these issues. He recently put up, as I said, this post on Huffington Post, talking about the new mandate for climate activists. So, did you see it, DR? Did you get a chance to read it?
It was a great piece, reminiscent of some of the points that Naomi Klein made in her book, "This Changes Everything: Capitalism Versus the Climate." The two main points Gelbspan made was that, quote, "global warming is no longer the exclusive purview of environmentalists. The world is waking up to the fact that climate change is not just another issue in this complicated world of proliferating issues." Unquote. He also goes on to note that the environmental community needs to enlist activist organizations around the world to mount a coordinated global effort to pressure the world's governments to prepare in concert for the coming breakdowns, unquote. And he also calls for the, quote, laying the groundwork for the creation of a new economic order, one based on equity and sustainability rather than economic concentration, exploitation, and environmental destruction, unquote.
And I think that, I mean, it's an interesting argument. In the sense, he makes the case that up until now, climate hawks and climate activists have been educators and essentially experts who know the magic of clean energy and trying to communicate that information to other people so that other people get the religion. He says that it's past time for that now, that it's too late, and now we need to be banding together with other groups that are outside of the nominal environmental movement, right? That we have to go out, we being the climate activists, need to go out and find alliances with other groups in order to pressure governments around the world to take action. But I mean, I guess it's a bigger picture than just, the self-identified climate hawk taking action. It's a call to arms and I think he explicitly says it, we, climate hawks, need to stop being the sort of the experts and become facilitators, right, to make these organizations come together. Do you think that makes sense?
It certainly makes sense, and it reminds me not only of the Klein piece, it reminds me of a segment that aired this week on MSNBC's The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, in which DeRay McKesson of the Black Lives Matter movement and David Archambault, I believe his name is pronounced, who is the leader of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, the water protectors standing up against the Dakota Access Pipeline, were talking about the connectivity between the Black Lives Matter movement and the movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline, Warren O'Donnell made the point that Native Americans were the first environmentalists and the first protesters against civil rights and justice. Mm-hmm. And DeRay McKisson made the point that even though he had not heard much from the media about this issue, once he understands the issue, he understands the parallel between what's the brutality that the Native American protesters are facing and the brutality that African Americans are facing, both from government officials, and he basically stands with him in solidarity with those protesters, just as Jesse Jackson, who was out in North Dakota standing in solidarity with the water protectors, also understands that they are basically fighters in the same struggle.
Right. I think that, again, from a climate perspective, you can look out and see, I mean, the waves of immigrants that are currently moving around the world are, as we say, a precursor of worse that will likely come over the next decades, right, of people being displaced. And somehow making common cause with those people to again, generate pressure for action. Because I think, I mean, from a climate perspective, if you just focus on sort of, say, Syrian immigrants, you can see that these people are the thin edge of the wedge, and that, you know, as sea levels rise and things like that happen, you're going to have many more displaced persons. It would be tough, I think, to have, if I was an immigrant from Syria, to sort of justify my actions on the basis of climate change, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, I mean, much more immediate things drive you. But somehow building the alliance to make the world a better place is the right, I think Gelbspan makes a good point.
Definitely. And it also, when he talks about how this is the issue that, if unchecked, will swamp all other issues, it reminds me of our friend Betsy Rosenberg's point that climate change is the great exacerbator. All sorts of whatever injustice exists in this world, whatever injustice exists in our society, climate change will make worse, whether it's discrimination, whether it's economic inequality, whether it's any form of oppression. We talk about the disproportionate toll that climate change takes on women worldwide. Mm-hmm. It will just make it worse. So those who are fighting against those forms of oppression and discrimination are natural allies of those who are fighting the problem of carbon pollution.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I underline this quote in the Gelbspan article. He says, maybe you read this before, DR, but he says, to remain relevant, climate activists need to abandon their role as experts and learn to function as facilitators. Mm-hmm. They need to realize that merely warning about the catastrophic potential of runaway warming and extolling the virtues of clean energy is not enough. They must embrace a new role as global catalysts by engaging people working on a range of other social, political, and economic issues. Mm-hmm. We need to dramatically broaden the understanding of their responsibility for the future. So there you go. I mean, it's an interesting read. Whether or not, I mean, I think Gelbspan's overall thing is a little bit depressing. I mean, he basically says, you know, we've lost the game. We can't stop climate change. There's already too much going on. I hope not to agree with that, but it's a thought-provoking piece. So I recommend it to folks to we'll put a link on the blog for it, right?
And as he points out, you know, one of the reasons why we've lost so much ground, literally and figuratively, is that we've waited so long. You know, he notes, quote, it didn't even surface as an issue in the public arena until 1988. And if you think about how much delay and how much inaction has gone on between 1988 and 2016, how much could have been done if we had taken some action in the late 1980s. I think we've mentioned before Al Gore in his book Earth and the Balance mentioning the 1990 Clean Air Act that regulated the pollutants that caused acid rain, there was an effort by Congress to put CO2 on the list of pollutants that would be regulated by the 1990 Clean Air Act, and the fossil fuel industry fought tooth and toenail to get rid of CO2 as a pollutant that would be regulated under that bill. And just imagine if CO2 fell under the purview of the 1990 Clean Air Act, how many lives would have been spared between 1990 and 2016? Yeah. It's just an immeasurable amount.
I guess, I mean, I hear you, but I mean, another way to look at it is that with an issue of this magnitude, of where fossil fuel use is ingrained in everything that we do, right? Mm-hmm. I think in 28 years since this issue sort of came above ground, we've come a long way. I mean, there's continuing opposition, but I mean, to change the course of civilization, which is essentially what we're trying to do. I mean, in 30 years, I think we've done a lot in 30 years. Maybe not enough, but we've done a lot in 30 years.
Yeah, that's the thing. Certainly not enough. And again, going back to that 1990 Clean Air Act, how if CO2 had been put in, it could have been a clean power plant of its own.
Right. Yeah, there'd be not all this hoo-ha about the Supreme Court and whatnot. Well, so there's an article from Ross Gelbspan I recommended reading. I guess the other interesting topic that came up this week is much more upbeat. The last one's an upbeat discussion, but this one's kind of technical and interesting. So let me set it up this way. It's a scientific question, but there's this concept in chemistry of something called a catalyst. It's a catalyst is actually, you know, the word gets thrown around a lot in common conversation, I say. And we just read it in this article from Ross Gelbspan that climate activists need to be a catalyst for change. Well, it turns out that in chemistry, catalyst has a very specific meaning. It is a material. A catalyst is a material that basically facilitates and makes it easier for a chemical reaction to happen. So it turns out that with that as backdrop, a couple of guys or a set of people, researchers down at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, were trying to figure out how to take carbon dioxide out of the air and turn it into ethanol. Ethanol is like alcohol. It's a fuel. We can burn it. There's ethanol in your gas. That's what you get from corn. The corn, you know, you go to the gas station, there's this 10% ethanol on the pump, right? It's that material. But you can it's possible to make ethanol out of carbon dioxide if you put enough energy into the reaction. You heat things up, you do all these stuff. Turns out that these guys at Oak Ridge put together a little bit of carbon, a little bit of copper, and a little bit of silicon. And when you put a voltage on that thing, that surface, all of a sudden the carbon dioxide in the air gets together on the surface with another carbon dioxide and makes the ethanol. So all of a sudden you have this very easy room temperature thing that is easy to build out of common materials, maybe not easy to build, but can be built out of common materials that takes carbon dioxide out of the air and makes it into a burnable fuel that you can use in your cigarette lighter or to run a power plant. And it suggests that if this technology works, it could become what is essentially a battery. I mean, you could have this thing hooked up next to a wind turbine, and when the wind turbine is not supplying energy to homes, they connect the electricity and the voltage to this array of carbon, silicon, and copper, and all of a sudden it starts taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and making it into a usable fuel. Did you see that, DR? Did you get a chance?
Yes, it's amazing, and the sort of reaction I had is that, number one, this shows you the importance of valuing science in American society, and number two, when we talk about issues of capturing carbon, sequestering carbon, you know, the issue of whether or not this constitutes a form of geoengineering, it's nice to see that this can be converted into ethanol, but we still have to have as a priority sort of keeping as much carbon into the ground, even if it can be converted into ethanol.
Right. And so that raises an interesting point about this technology, right, which is in its infancy. But, I mean, these people, you know, think they can scale it up to larger. I mean, what they're doing is taking existing carbon dioxide that's in the air, putting it into a material that you can burn as a fuel, which would then, after you've made the electricity, with burning the ethanol, the carbon dioxide goes back into the air. And so from a carbon dioxide emission perspective, it is zero emissions because you have not increased the amount. You took a little bit of CO2 out, then you put the same amount of CO2 back, so net-net everything's the same. And the question is whether or not that is an acceptable path forward. Right. Do you want to be taking the stuff out and then burning it to put it back up again, even if it's net neutral? Right. There's no new increase in the CO2 level. Is that a good way to go?
Of course, the problem is we have to sort of decrease the overall amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and not just keep it in a balance, because, you know, if it's kept in a balance of 400 parts per million, we're still imbalanced.
Right. But I mean, it has this the capability to be a storage form of storage of electricity. And again, sometimes that baffles people because it's such a weird thing. But if you have a wind turbine that's generating electricity, but it's generating it at 3 a.m. and nobody's awake to turn on the TV, then that electricity is wasted because it has to be used at the time it's made.
Exactly.
But a battery is something that you can charge up. You can drive the electricity into a battery and then reclaim that electricity, just like with your laptop, right? You charge up your laptop. Well, this method would do the same thing. You would use the extra electricity from a wind turbine to take the CO2 out of the air, capture it into this liquid, and then when you want it, you burn the liquid to make electricity again. And if it's cheap and it works, I mean, if it's a storage solution for energy, I think it's a very interesting and attractive idea. I'm just charmed by the whole thing.
It gives new meaning to the term energy independence, doesn't it?
Right. I mean, it's fascinating because this catalyst I talked about before is made with what's called carbon nanotubes and copper nanoparticles. So a carbon nanotube. So it turns out that these technologists, they can basically assemble atom by atom these little Lego structures of atoms, right? And they can make shapes that they want. And it turns out carbon, in the right conditions, makes these little sort of like whiskers, little tubes. And I guess from what I was looking at, they manufacture these little tiny and basically atomic scale little carbon tubes. And then on top of it, they put a little tiny copper nanoparticle. And somehow that is the magic catalyst that makes the chemical reaction go. Now, we've talked before in this program about the dangers of nanotechnology, because all those little carbon, copper nanoparticles, I mean, if they get in your lungs, who the heck knows what's going to happen, right?
Exactly.
And we've had the whole issue of the ceramic beads in your makeup, right, in the facial detergent, right, that then all those little carbon little ceramic seeds go into the water and the fish eat them and then the fish die and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's kind of an intriguing idea. I mean, I'm charmed. The scientist part of me likes the idea of being able to store that electricity in ethanol. Especially, and I guess the other thing I was thinking, if you could take carbon dioxide out of the air and make it into liquid ethanol, right, that is probably a component for some other material that you don't have to, like a plastic or something.
Yep.
I mean, maybe you could make clothing, rayon clothing out of that ethanol, which would then bind the carbon dioxide up in your clothes, and you wouldn't have to burn it back. I mean, who knew? Not a bad idea. I mean, as you say, it's the marvel of science. You never know what's going to pop out of it, and you just kind of have to take it at face value and see what... see which way it goes. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, yeah, that's the science lesson for today. I'm sure everyone at home is, their eyes are rolling back in their head and they're very much bored of talking about catalysts. I hope it was not that boring. I hope those of you who are still with us will know that you can check the links. Check the links on the Oak Ridge National Laboratory ethanol catalyst story at the blog. It'll be on massclimateaction.net/ massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find the podcast on our Facebook page. It's /massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or any of the common podcast distribution networks. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on SoundCloud. So, DR, we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you can go Google Catalyst if you didn't understand what I had to say. Bye-bye, everybody. Take care.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.